Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show today by talking with you about exercising in hot weather. And our two experts back with us, Lori Dine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to see you in person.
It's fantastic to be back in person. I'm so happy.
It's good to see you. Jill Thein-Nissenbaum, our other guest, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Jill, great to see you in the studio.
It's great to be in the studio as well. Nice walk on the way over here. It's fantastic to be out and about.
Well, as we talk with Jill and Lori, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. You need some advice on hot weather exercise? Join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. You know, last week I was talking with a couple of older friends who had golfed. They'd gone to Odana Golf Course, and they golfed their normal 18 holes, and they walk, and it was 94 degrees.
Right.
And I said, are you guys nuts? You know, it's a six-mile walk, pushing a 40-pound bag around for 6 miles.
And how did they do?
Well, by the time they were, you know, one of them said by about hole 12, they were just, let's just get this over with, and just kept slogging through and didn't have any fun at all. But I like, you guys got to have a heat stroke or something.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to be very careful in this weather and making sure that you're adequately trained for the environment that you're exercising in. So one of the things we know is that with the climate change, we're seeing warmer temperatures in places that we haven't seen them. So the 94 degree temperature is a great example of in Wisconsin in June. That's somewhat atypical. So people aren't getting a chance to acclimatize to the environment as much as they have in the past, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the weather turns nice, and it turned nice pretty quickly. You know, we had a lot of rain, and so people didn't get out and do the things that they wanted to do. And then all of a sudden, it's nice, and they don't have time to acclimate to it. They want to get out, and they want to golf that 18 holes, or they want to go out and get all that stuff in their garden right away because it's already late, and then they end up overdoing it. So the same kind of advice that we give in the winter to do things in small spurts makes sense in the heat as well.
Well, and then there's some research out there, Jill, that shows that exercising can be safe for both older adults and kids. That's what we're always talking about. Older adults and kids are the ones that have the problems.
Absolutely. We used to have this understanding that it's now not so true that they don't acclimatize to the environment as well as normal population or normal adults. And what we know now is that, especially in the aging population and the studies that they did, they considered older people 55.
That was terrible. That was disheartening to me.
Right.
Yes.
But I thought, wow. I thought a lot about my sister, Lori, and myself and our brother, Scott. We're doing a 500-mile bike trip at the end of July. And I'm the youngest. And so I have older siblings who, you know, are they going to be acclimatized appropriately? And is heat going to be a problem? And what we know from research is if you have a really good cardiovascular base and really good maximal oxygen consumption and your cardiovascular system is efficient, you can actually train in the heat fairly well. Now, that doesn't mean that, oh, I'm in really good shape. I can go out and bike for 7 hours on the first hot day of the year. But what it means is that you will tolerate the heat well. And so to slowly build up your resistance in the heat is fine. You just have to have that good cardiovascular base going into it.
Exactly. And a good sweating mechanism. What we know is that as we age, our sweat ducts don't sweat quite as much as they have in the past. And people will say, well, you know, I was outside, I went for a run, I went for a bike ride, I golfed 18 holes, and I just sweat something profusely. But it's important to know that just because you're sweat doesn't mean that your body is cooling. On a humid day, your sweat can evaporate. The actual cooling to your body happens when the sweat evaporates from your body, not when it sits on your skin and you're soaking wet. So it's the evaporation process that actually cools you, not the sweating per se.
So what's the recommend? You know, I was thinking about when you mentioned your 500 mile. The last time I did a 300 mile bike ride, I don't think I ever went the 100 miles in a day kind of thing, but I did a lot of biking around the lake and,
right.
You know, maybe even 30 miles or so.
Exactly.
I did a lot of that
yep.
beforehand, and I really had no trouble hitting.
Exactly. So I've been starting to bike outside a little bit, and I actually even waited yesterday for it to get a little bit warmer before I went out and biked. So I didn't do it first thing in the morning, but I was like, you know, I just want to acclimatize a little bit to the heat. And I did just fine. What we will do on our bike trip is one of the main things we really pay attention to is the heat, or when things are going to get hot the next day, and the humidity. And that really dictates how early we get up and ride. If it's going to be a really hot day, we'll get up and start riding really early and try and get a lot of miles under our belt so we don't spend 90% of our time out in the heat. So
yeah,
we really try and plan accordingly and hydrate really well, make sure we're hydrated well the night before, things like that.
Right. And we stop frequently as well. So we'll bike. Yeah.
20 miles maybe. Or...
Exactly. Yeah. 20 miles and then we'll stop and get something to drink, get some food, get off our bikes for a little bit, and then we'll get back on and we'll do that sort of all day long.
Right.
You know, Julie, you were telling me about this wet bulb globe temperature scale.
Yes.
Which I think would be useful for anybody.
Absolutely. So there's a standardized table that people smarter than me have developed. It's been around for a very long time. It is called the Wet Bulb Globe Temperature. And on one side of the table, you will find the actual air temperature. And on the other side, you will find percent humidity. And when you draw a line where those two intersect, you'll actually find what the actual intensity is or feels like. And it's color coded so you can see if you're in a green area or a yellow area or a red area or a black area where exercise is not advised. And it's so funny, Lori, that you talked about evaporation. My family and I were just on vacation. We were in South Carolina and my husband and I played pickleball for an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I was drenched, like wet like I've never been. And it was the humidity, Lori. Like you said, nothing evaporated off of me. And the rest of the day, I just felt kind of lousy.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, you know what? It felt kind of crappy.
You know what they say? It's not the heat. It's the humidity.
And they're correct. It definitely plays a role.
Well, let's see what Chris in La Crosse has to say. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is, I raise the temperature on my air conditioning to reduce a little bit of energy uses. But I'm wondering if having a higher temperature in my house, even if it's a little bit higher than I'm mostly comfortable with, is helpful for acclimating to the heat, or if it'd be better to have a cooler house and like more rapidly get my body temperature back down when I come inside.
So I don't think if it's a small few degree swing, Chris, I don't think that's going to be impactful for you, especially if you're keeping your heart rate at a normal resting level in your house. I don't think it's going to make a difference at all. Do you, Lori?
No. If your household activities are basically sedentary,
yeah,
I wouldn't think that a few degrees makes a difference, although it's very good for the environment.
Exactly. Good for you.
So, good for you on that. But, you know, if you have a place in your house where you exercise, so for example, I have a room downstairs where I exercise and I can open that up to the outside and block it off from the rest of the house, I can heat that place up and I can exercise there, but I wouldn't change the heat in my entire house during my sedentary activities.
Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Tyrone in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, thank you.
Good morning, my friend Larry. Good morning, ladies. so glad to be on the air with you and in your presence there. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Tyrone W speaking. Yeah, northwest side of Milwaukee. Well, I'm in my early 60s now. Birthday coming up in July on the 28th. I'll be 64 then. But I know I got my first trophy in baseball. Ran track early, but they said the sweating, you drink plenty of water there for the sweating. But they gave us a salt tablet, and they explained to us this is for your balance, your dizziness, because if you lose all your salt there and got water in you, you're going to get dizzy. But I've been off the pork for a long time, so I've got to get my salt from something else other than, the
salt tablets.
Yeah, right.
Well,
right.
What is that? You know, was that good advice that Tyrone and kids were?
We all had that. And if you look at the electrolyte drinks, they most all contain sodium. So if you're the rule of thumb is if you're involved in an activity under 90 minutes, water is sufficient. You don't need extra salt. Most Americans get enough salt in their diet, even without the pork, Tyrone, that you really don't need extra salt. So for us, if we're biking for 7-8 hours and it's a really hot day, we will look for an electrolyte drink rather than just water because you can deplete your sodium levels. Mm-hmm. So it's something to be concerned about if you're in a really big endurance event, if you're running Leadville or something like that. But for the most part, if you're an activity under 90 minutes, you don't need extra salt. Is that what you're...
Correct, yeah. And there were a whole bunch of studies. I don't know if you remember, Lori, when the pickle juice came out.
Yes.
They were looking at pickle juice. Is pickle juice a good replacement? And part of it is because of the sodium mm-hmm. content. So all of these things we're talking about, a sodium replacement. And the rule of thumb is, again, like Lori said, you don't need to be drinking pickle juice. A Gatorade or something like that, that's about 6%, I believe, is the magic number, will be just fine.
Tyrone, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. If you have a physical therapy question, I hope you will. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Molly Stentz, our on-air producer, Lee Rayburn, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody talking about physical therapy, of course. Things to think about when exercising in hot weather, but also taking other physical therapy questions as well. And I hope you join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. What are the signs, by the way, of heat exhaustion?
So, right, there's a couple different categories of heat. There's heat stress, we call them heat-related illnesses. There's heat stress, there's heat exhaustion, and then there's heat stroke. And heat exhaustion, the difference between heat exhaustion and heat stroke is a difference in your core body temperature. Heat exhaustion is less than 104 degrees when taken rectally. And typically with heat exhaustion, you have profuse sweating. And you don't have a loss of consciousness and you're still cognitively aware of things that are going on. Versus when you get to heat stroke, your core body temperature is typically elevated greater than 104 degrees, you've discontinued sweating, so you have actually dry skin, and there's a lot of cognitive impairments that are seen with it, and that is a medical emergency. So you don't want to mess around with these heat illnesses for sure.
Yeah, I can remember a time or two thinking back to high school track and where people passed out and the ambulance had to come quickly and it's not good.
there's some really amazing new devices out there because there are so many events that take place remotely, and so you can't have a big cooling tub there full of ice or things like that. And there are cooling bags now that they call them almost like tacos, where you can fill a plastic bag full of ice water and kind of zip it up, and the patient lays in it, and you can cool someone rapidly with what's a relatively portable device. So with the advent of those, I think hopefully we'll see a decrease in the overall mortality rate seen with heat-related illness.
Let's take another call. Jay in Jefferson, on to you now. Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, good sir.
What can we do for you today?
I just have a quick question related to string instrument playing and the long-term effects of that hobby.
So,
and what's the question, Jay? And tell us about the instrument.
My question is, if I play a stringed instrument from the time I'm 16 up until I'm about 60 or however long I end up to live, I plan on playing lifelong, playing guitar and banjo and violin and cello. I was just curious if there's any recorded history of people developing arthritis or any kind of sensory perception related disease from that hobby.
Yeah.
So the good news for you, Jay, is you play a variety of instruments, of stringed instruments, all which place you in different postures. So the biggest problem with any single activity, whether it's playing a single musical instrument or playing a single sport or having a single hobby, is you tend to find yourself in the same postures, working through the same range of motion, working the same joints and muscles over and over and over again. And that will make you susceptible to overuse regardless of the activity. It sounds as though this is an avocation for you, not your vocation. So you have some control over the number of hours that you play this. So I don't think you would have any issues with this as long as you're aware of your posture, using good techniques. You're keeping yourself strong and flexible in all the joints and muscles that play these instruments. I think in terms of like psychosocial health, it's a very good thing to do. So health is just not physical. It is a multidimensional group of domains. So I would say carry on and enjoy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I would think, let's say I'm thinking of the Rolling Stones. You play your whole life the same instrument.
Right.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. That's right. Anytime you're doing the same activity over and over in the same posture over and over, you're setting yourself up for challenges.
Right. Paul McCartney comes to mind for me. He's turning 80 or just turned 80.
Wow.
And is still performing. And, you know, from a PT perspective, I was at his show a while ago, and his neck position, you know, for him to open his mouth that loud, he really goes into a lot of cervical extension. And I always just wonder if he has neck pain.
I hope you could still enjoy the show and weren't too focused on worrying about his neck.
Right. Well, maybe Paul will call and let
us know. There you go. Exactly. There you go. Exactly. Yes. So a worldwide audience here.
Jay, thanks again. Now, Pete in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having me. I'm calling with a question about my shoulders. All my life I played baseball, and I'm very certain that based on my signs and symptoms and two visits with an orthopedic doctor that I have, you know, a minor kind of tear in my rotator cuff. And my question is, my surgeon gives me the impression that I have to have an MRI to really look at the detail of how bad the tear is. And I'm confused because I'm under the impression that can't I just I'm not good with MRIs. I don't know if I could do it. So can't I just start physical therapy and see how much it helps?
Absolutely.
So I get the impression they're saying, well, if it's a certain type of tear, physical therapy could make it worse. I mean, that doesn't sound like it. I don't know about that.
No, I think there are many times, Pete, that what physical therapists do first and foremost is treat the patient that's in front of us. And so a good physical therapist will meet you at the level that your shoulder is presenting. So you do not need an MRI to start physical therapy. It's not going to change your course of care. As a matter of fact, there are many patients that we see clinically that may or may not have a cuff tear. And we treat them with what we see in front of us. Lori's shaking her head, yes.
Oh, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. I don't think you need imaging unless you're planning on some other intervention right. besides physical therapy. And I think you should always start with physical therapy and see how far that takes you. Is your shoulder going to be perfect? No, you may have certain activities or certain things that stir it up a little bit, but you may say, you know what, I'm fine with that because right. it's better than going through surgery. And you never know what the outcome of surgery is going to be. So absolutely start with physical therapy. You do not need an MRI to start PT, only if you're going to go with another intervention such as injections or surgery. Then they want to know what they're dealing with.
There you go. Thank you, Pete, for calling. Let's turn to Mark in Door County. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Well, I was listening to your program, and it reminded me of a fella I knew on a varsity ball team many years ago. And he was a fabulous pitcher. And he, at the end of every game, the coach insisted that he do laps or back and forths from center field to home base as many times as he pitched. It kind of gave him a more, it rounded him out, brought him back to center because you become lopsided. Now, that would be tough to do with an instrument unless you could switch from a right-handed base to a left-handed base. But I think to find an opposite something.
I understand what you're saying, Mark, is that if you're working in one posture, working in one position all the time, you want to work the other direction. And I do agree with that. So for people who, for example, work forward flexed all the time, maybe they're sitting at a computer like many of you might be right now, and you're flexed at your hips and you're forward bent and maybe your head is out of position, you absolutely want to work the other direction. Now, whether running back and forth from home plate to center field really works the pitcher the opposite direction, I'm not seeing that right now, but I understand the underlying theory and do agree with that.
Yeah, principle right. of it. Exactly. Okay, Mark, thank you. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Rebecca in Mosinee, we turn to you now. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Okay, I'm calling about an issue that I've had for years now. I'm 30 now, but when I was 25, I was out in Colorado doing some firefighting kind of work, and I experienced what I think was some sort of, you know, heat exhaustion. I was hospitalized, and ever since then, I have had extreme issues with the heat. It doesn't, you know, when it's hot like this, I really just don't even exercise. But, you know, even if it's just like in the 80s and I go out for a run in the afternoon, I just have a lot of issues. And even on days like today, like if I'm just sitting around doing nothing, I just feel exhausted. I ran a marathon back when I was 26. With my sis out in Montana, and all my training, I tried to do a lot of training in the afternoons in the heat, and I still had issues at the end of that race where I almost passed out and had to go to the medical times and all that, you know, fun stuff. So my
right.
question to you guys is what can I do about that?
So first of all, you bring up a really good point. We know that people who have a significant episode of a heat-related illness, and it sounds like if you were hospitalized for years, it was a substantial heat-related illness, that they are much more susceptible and have the exact situation you talked about are have less tolerance to the heat as they move on. So I think you're doing a lot of things right in that you're trying to acclimatize. By running in the afternoon and things like that, you might be trying to go at it too hard. I think I'd probably take a step back and slow down how I acclimatize and work a lot more on getting a really good cardiovascular base going and then slowly introducing the heat.
Yeah, it's unclear whether or not your body will ever get to where it was before. You don't know. But anytime you're going back to something and trying to get back to some activity, taking a very structured approach to it. And we typically say you need to be able to exercise at the same dosage. So for you, it would be the same wet bulb globe temperature that Jill talked about earlier, and the same distance for three sessions in a row without heat-related symptoms before you increased. And then you would decide if your increase should be an increase in the temperature or an increase in your duration of activity. So it just has to be really clear and structured and stepwise.
Yeah. Good luck with that, Rebecca. Thank you so much for calling. Tiger in Port Wing, we turn to you. Hi, thanks for calling.
Well, good morning. I listen to your program as much as I can. And my question is, my wife has had some strokes, and I'd like to know if physical therapy is specific for stroke patients.
Yes. So brain attack or a stroke can be treated by physical therapists. There are physical therapists who specialize in what we call neurologic-related disorders, and having a brain attack or a stroke, something along those lines, would be who your wife would need to see. They're very skilled at identifying the different impairments that go with which side of the brain is impacted, and yet your wife would benefit from seeing a physical therapist and potentially an occupational therapist as well to make sure that she's, getting her optimal skills and functions back.
Yeah. Right. Do you look, how do you find one?
So where does Tiger live?
Port Wing, Wisconsin.
Port Wing. Where's that, Larry?
So that is near, that's in the Door County area, Green Bay, Door County area,
okay.
I believe.
Mm-hmm. Great. So definitely starting in Green Bay would be a place, one of the bigger hospital systems there probably has an outpatient rehabilitation facility. And you'd want to find the neurologic clinic or something along those lines.
Right. And there are people who are neurologic clinical specialists. They are board certified in neurologic physical therapy. So you can become board certified in a number of subspecialty areas. So you might want to look for somebody who is board certified in neurologic physical therapy in that area.
Actually, I think Port Wing is in Bayfield area.
Okay, so then somebody up in the Bayfield area or
Superior could be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you'd want to start with one of the big hospital systems,
right,
because they're most likely to have the kind of person you're looking for, and they might also be able to connect you with somebody who's closer to where you live. So it's easier to start in the big place and work your way out.
Tiger, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Somebody was wondering about the effects. What is it? Or what do they suspect is involved when you have a heat, you know, an extreme heat event like that, that then makes you more susceptible? Is there, what, there must
What's
be something,
mechanism?
Yeah, what, there must be something in the body that.
That's a great question. So we know with all of these heat-related illnesses that we're, the biggest thing that we're concerned about is your internal or core body temperature. There's been a lot of research looking at this. Can you take their temperature orally? Can you take their temperature across the forehead? And the answer is no. You need to do a rectal temperature to make sure you have the accurate reading on the internal organs, because that's what you're most concerned about is kidney failure, multi-system organ failure. So I don't know if once they reach a certain temperature, if they're just much more susceptible to it again. I don't know about the physiology behind that.
Yeah, I'm not clear on the physiology either, except that, you know, one of it may be that you already have a predisposition to it, which is why you had a severe heat illness in the first place. And then once that system gets triggered, it's a fairly complex system of feedback from your blood temperature and a lot of hormonal responses that increase the circulation to your skin. So it could be part of that whole hormonal chain that causes the cooling response. The threshold for that is lowered. So the threshold for that system to be triggered is now lowered as a protective response because the impact of increased core temperature is so devastating on your life that it's just more the threshold is lowered for triggering the response. That'd be my guess.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good guess, I think.
Thanks, Larry.
I was trying to figure out what the heck. But that's reasonable for sure. Dennis in Afton, Minnesota, we're on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, hi, Larry and guests. I really appreciate your show. And my question is, ice baths. I see or hear in the news sometimes that pro athletes, after a big game or something, they'll jump into an ice bath and you see the ice floating on the water. I've got the good fortune, I'm fairly close to a cold trout stream, so I'm promoting the preservation of cold trout streams because I don't have to have that ice bath. I go jump in and it lasts me throughout the day. But I'm wondering, can I overdo or undo that? What's your information on that?
So that's a really good question. So when somebody has a heat-related illness and is in kind of that crisis mode, for example, heat exhaustion, one of the things we know regarding outcomes is the faster we can cool that individual down, the more likely they're going to have a better outcome. So rapid cooling for somebody who's in a heat crisis is very, very important. And you'll see people jumping in ice baths or packing their armpits, their axillas, the behind their knees, things like that to get at where blood comes to the surface to cool them down rapidly, because rapid cooling is very important. It does have an impact on your cardiovascular system, though, and it is a shock to the system. So unless you're in that mode, I don't know that there's, and I'm looking at you, Lori, I don't know that there's a reason that you would do it on a regular basis. If you had a cardiac history, it might be a little challenging.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do it if I had a cardiac history.
Right.
But, you know, there are those people who jump into Lake Superior in January on a weekly basis and who swear by it.
Yeah.
So, as I've mentioned to people before, there's a rule of 50s. I don't know if you heard the rule of 50s. But in 50-degree water, 50% of the people will be dead in 50 minutes.
Oh.
So if the water is really cold, you might want to get in and cool off for a few minutes, but I wouldn't stay there a long time.
Right.
And is there something to be, gained by doing it repetitively? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know, I don't know if you remember the year we did the bike trip and it was over 100 for many days.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you did it that year with us. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was over 100 every day. And at the end of our day, we would go get in a pool. And if we couldn't get in a pool, you could feel the effects of that the rest of the day. Like you could not get cool. Even if you went in air conditioning, it wasn't the same as being immersed in that cold water where that cold water just pulled the heat right out of your body.
Well, and that's such an interesting point, because they know from a rapid cooling option when somebody is in a heat crisis that ice immersion is the best way to go. That's if you have an ice bath available, that is your number one choice. And then your second choice would be something that we talked about earlier, kind of the taco, where you wrap them in ice water. But truly, that full body immersion is far and above, research shows, the best strategy.
Well, then every millimeter of your skin is covered.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yep.
Dennis, thank you so much for calling. Gail in Watertown, it's your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi, I need double knee replacement, and my BMI right now is 50, and rumor has it if I get to 45, I can get that knee replacement, but I want to be as fit as possible going into surgery, and I know there's swimming. It's like 35-minute drive from my house. It's a pain to drive there. And do you have some advice for me?
So I love the motivation you have, Gail. This is fantastic. Is there a place that you can go that has perhaps something like a recumbent bike or a new step or a different piece of cardiovascular activity or a cardiovascular device that you could use that would not be weight bearing that might be as beneficial?
Yes, those devices are there. I did not understand a recumbent bike would be possible with my knees because they're bone on bone, you know, and have been for several years.
So one of the things that I recommend to people is to, if you can, get that free week pass at a gym and try the different equipment. So the bikes are not weight bearing on your knees, so they may or may not be okay. You just don't know. For some people, the bike is a godsend for their knees, and other people, not so great. There's also those little pedalers you can get for at home that you can order online, and I've had people get those. And that's a way to sort of road test what a recumbent would be like because you sit on a chair and you pedal and you can try that. But I really like the idea of going to a gym for a week, trying different equipment, see what you like, see what works, see what doesn't. And then maybe you want to purchase a used recumbent bike for at home, especially if it's a long way for you to get somewhere. Now, I understand a pool is 35 minutes away. I don't know if that's different in the summer. So, you know, in the winter, your only option is an indoor pool. But there's a lot of places that have outdoor pools that are accessible in the summer, and you might be able to actually get started there then see. And then thereafter, if you're not successful on land, I would drive 35 minutes in order to get that knee replacement, because if you're bone on bone in both knees, you're really going to need to exercise to both keep your knees healthy and to be able to get that knee replacement.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Gail, for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at physical therapy on the show today with our two guests, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne Brody, Physical Therapist and an Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Bob in Cleveland, Ohio, up next. Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, this is actually the second time I called a couple months ago during your show and asked the ladies for some advice about what I could do to increase the range of motion on my shoulder. And they offered me some advice. I took it. I actually wound up going to a physical therapist instead of the doctor. And he almost gave the same advice. And so it's been working out. It's been real great. My shoulder's back to normal. Oh, and I'm happy. So thank you, ladies.
Yeah.
And the other comment is for the person that called in a little earlier about his wife having a stroke. I had a stroke in 2014, and when I got out of the hospital, they told me immediately to follow up with physical therapy so I could start to basically walk again, because the stroke I had affected my right side where I couldn't coordinate walk. I couldn't bend over without falling. So I went to a physical therapy, and after 6 months, I'm pretty much good as new.
Oh,
it's a great story. Thank you so
That's
much for
great.
Sharing that.
Are you exercising, Bob?
It's a little harder. I drive a truck. I'm over the road. But yeah, I try and do some exercises. I try and stay fit. I do a lot of moving around stuff at home, which helps with the range of motion and works just about every muscle of my body.
Yeah. Yeah, all right, good.
And by the way, Carol Lee in Grafton had called, and this relates right to what Bob's, a little bit to what Bob's talking about. She winds up having to go on long car trips and wonders about exercises on long car trips, and you know, especially with her knees, apparently, there are some things that go on.
Right. Well, we encourage frequent stops is very, very important. And when you get out, as we talked about earlier, you need to move things in the opposite direction. So there you are sitting in a car with your knees probably bent to 90 degrees. You need to get out, straighten out your knees, do some stretching for the muscles down the back of your legs. If you're not the driver and you can put your passenger seat really far back, you can do some knee bending and straightening, kind of kicking towards the dashboard, and do that frequently while you're driving. That's a really good strategy. But you need to kind of pump the fluid around.
Yeah. And if you're a passenger, you can also, if you have little resistive bands, you can do some little arm exercises with your resistive band. You can put it around your knees and do some exercise with resistive bands. But as Jill said, stopping and getting out of the car frequently, and she mentioned your knees, but also your hips, because mm-hmm. you're flexed to 90 degrees. We see so often people who are really tight in their hip flexor muscles because we sit so much now. And those muscles also attach to the front of your low back. So when those muscles are tight, they can contribute to back pain. So back pain isn't always primarily coming just from your back, but from tightness around your hips as well. So getting out and doing that. And if you're traveling, taking resistive bands along, they're very light, they don't take up a lot of space, and you can do a really nice exercise program while you're on the road just with resistive bands.
Let's take another call. Brad in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. Hi, Brad.
Hi. You were speaking about, you know, core temperature and stuff. I used to run marathons back in the 70s. And one of the things they told us that I read was keep drinking, because if you're in a situation where it's warm and you're, you know, losing water, by the time you realize it, you're behind the curve and on the precipice of being in real trouble. And I'm sure that contributes to, like, core temperature, because if you have less water, you're not going to be able to sweat it out. The body will hold on to it. My second question, though, actual question, was once heat stress gets into the organ, your liver, your intestines, you know, your spleen, all of that, do those, you know, do those organs ever regenerate themselves if they're damaged?
Those are great questions. So first and foremost, you had mentioned about drinking, and you're correct. Your thirst mechanism is kind of delayed, and it also, when you think you're fully hydrated, you're actually really not. You're still about 8 ounces short. So there is a kind of flaw in our system where, yes, you need to start drinking early and drink often. And even when you think you're adequately hydrated, you should still drink a little more. Now, regarding the do those organs regenerate? So all of the potential damage that we see with heat-related illness with an increase in your core body temperature is related to the length of time that your body is at that core temperature, and then the actual temperature itself. So do those systems regenerate? I'm going to answer that softly and say probably, but it's the damage will definitely be impacted by those variables, the how high the temperature is and how long your body experienced that temperature.
Right, and probably any underlying health conditions right. that you might have that have already put those systems at risk. And one other thought about the first part of your statement, and that is on a hot day when you're sweating, your body cannot metabolize fluids as fast as you lose them. So it's a two-part issue. One is that your thirst mechanism doesn't kick in until you've already lost a fair amount of fluid. And as you replenish it, if it's really hot, your body can't metabolize it as quickly, metabolize and absorb it as quickly as you're losing it. So you're always going to be running a deficit.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling. I was thinking back to the older golfer who I was talking to. He said he made some side comment saying he did drink quite a bit, but he said it unusually for him, he didn't have to pee.
Right.
No.
Well,
yeah.
And those are the things we get concerned about, is not only the frequency of urination, but the color of your urination. And that's kind of an awkward conversation to have with people, but you want your urine color to be kind of a pale straw yellow. And your first morning void is actually very indicative of your overall hydration status. So that first, after you've been, you know, not, as long as you don't pee in the middle of the night, but as long as you've, you know, kind of been sleeping all night and you get up and you go to the restroom, that first morning void should still be kind of a pale straw yellow color. And if it's a darker green or brown or a dark yellow, that's an indication that you still aren't adequately hydrated.
Good points. Dave in Spring Valley, we turn to you next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm 70 years old. Back when I was 18, I broke my right leg just above my ankle. About 5 years ago, I was having ankle problems on that one. And the surgeon I went to said that he recommended to straighten the leg first and then replace the ankle, which is what we did. Unfortunately, the leg straightening didn't go well, and it never really healed good. And the end result after a number of more surgeries was that the bone that accumulated around that break point is now kind of infringing on the ankle movement. And so my motion is severely restricted on that ankle, to the point where I step on the outside of the foot first, and I'm having problems there. So my question is, first off, one more thing. When I went back to him, he said, well, there's two options. One is to get a orthotic insert to try to take some pressure off the outside of that foot, or he could do another surgery and try to remove some of that excess bone to make a little more movement. And I've been thinking that maybe there's a possibility that some physical therapy could assist that range of motion problem. I did have physical therapy after the surgeries for a while and so forth, but it just seems like it seems like I want to just force, you know, some more motion into that, which I can't really do. But
right, no, I definitely think that a revisit to a physical therapist. It sounds like you had some physical therapy, Dave, but probably revisiting with a physical therapist and seeing what your options are is a really good strategy. And there might be a orthotic that your physician mentioned that might be a good strategy for you. And the other thing I would consider is, I was thinking about a rocker bottom shoe. Is that what you wrote?
That's
you wrote?
What I wrote down.
Oh, good.
Well, rocker bottom shoe.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
There you go. Then you can talk about that.
Oh, okay. So, you know, orthotics, you know, potentially orthotics work for some people. I would probably try a rocker bottom shoe first if you haven't tried that. And that can sometimes accommodate limited motion. So I would start with the physical therapist, because there's a lot of moving parts here, Dave, and it's a little hard to know what the right answer is without seeing your ankle. So I would go see a physical therapist, have them examine your ankle, look at the mobility of the various joints in your ankle and foot, and see where they can steal some motion from. And then you can ask that physical therapist if they think a rocker bottom shoe would be helpful for you.
What are these rocker bottom shoes? What are they like anyway? I mean, are they? They're, is it a big rock?
Yeah. Well, they're rounded on the bottom, and so instead of having like a stiff bottom, where the motion, the roll from your heel to your foot comes through the joints in your foot, the roll actually comes from the design of the bottom of the shoe.
Oh.
So they can be a little bit tricky until you get used to them, because you can fall off sideways. And so Dave, if he's walking on the outside of his foot, would want to be careful that he doesn't fall off the side of his shoe.
Right. And you may want a little orthoses in that rocker bottom shoe just to level out his medial lateral, is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know if they're going to shift immediately. I really get nervous playing around with an orthotic and shifting a lot of loads around without looking at the status of the various joints, because you could be robbing Peter to pay Paul, where you shift the load from one place onto someplace else that is then going to subsequently break down.
I think the orthotic, I like the idea of putting an orthotic in once you get all that mobility from a physical therapist. You get what you're going to get, and then you can
then accommodate what's left.
Exactly.
That's a great strategy.
And a physical therapist will definitely help you on that, Dave. Thanks very much for calling. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody, our guests today, and they will be with us right up till 12:30. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about physical therapy with our regular guest, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Hope you can join in with your questions. Our lines are all filled right now, so I'll wait to give the number, and we'll just go to the phones and to Carol in Crystal Lake, Illinois.
I was calling about my husband. He had two operations, one 2 years ago this summer for minor problems. I guess he said that the doctors are trying to make room for his spinal cord because he had severe sharp pains. He's in the Hines Medical VA system in Chicago. And then the second one was last summer, June of 2021, and he had a laminectomy through his neck. And that was because he had some neck pain there. And so now he's got three ruptured discs. I'm sure that's all kind of involved in the same thing. But my question is, I've noticed, because we've been married 45 years, I've noticed that, you know, his upper body, and, you know, he was in the infantry and one of the wars and, you know, in terrific shape. And now he, you know, he's losing muscle mass. You know, in his chest and that. And I'm just wondering, is that going to contribute to his pain? If, you know, the way I'm looking at it is like your muscles and ligaments and bones are stacked together and work together. And if one is out of whack.
Right. Well, and if he had a surgery to kind of make room for his spinal cord, it sounded to me like he probably had either central stenosis or foraminal stenosis, and then he would have impairment in his nervous system. So the nerves may not be communicating with the muscles or getting to the muscles, which may also result in atrophy of those muscles. So you kind of get this vicious cycle going of muscle weakness, disuse, atrophy, pain, all of those things. So it sounds to me like he's got a lot going on if he had a laminectomy and he had, it sounds like, surgery for central stenosis.
Yeah. Was that first surgery in his neck as well?
That was the second, but I should say he had a complete knee restoration because he had broken his knee like when he was 35 on a ladder thing. But and he went through extensive physical therapy after that, like for 6 months. So.
Right. For his first spinal surgery, where you said they were making room for his spinal cord, was that in his neck or was it in his low back?
In his back.
In his low back.
I can't say for sure, but it was in his back because I asked him, you know, why did they do that?
Right. So, is the loss of muscle mass in his upper body inevitable? And I would say no. So he had a laminectomy, and that's usually to make room for when you have foraminal stenosis. So for the nerves that come out and go to your arms, et cetera. So if he hasn't had physical therapy, and if he's in the VA system, he should have access to physical therapy for sure. He should get into physical therapy because otherwise, as Jill said, you start this vicious cycle of pain, decreased activity, and then loss of muscle strength. And then when you lose that muscle strength, you lose sort of the shock absorption system for your spine and your skeletal system. You really need to have strong muscles and strong and good mobility in your neck so that those loads are distributed over a larger area and you're not getting this focal loading that wears out one segment. So he should absolutely be in physical therapy to prevent that loss of muscle mass that you're noticing.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Kathleen emailed, she wonders what is a major PT center in Madison to do a state-of-the-art gait analysis. She says, I live in Lake Geneva and have a complicated issue regarding the lower leg with old anterior horn cell disease, West Nile as well as probably a post-polio thing too from years back.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just looking for a physical therapy assessment of your gait, I would see someone in neurologic rehabilitation, especially if it's post-polio. They're found at the Middleton Clinic.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in the UW system. So I would probably go to the UW system. We also have a gait lab, which is more for athletes. Mm-hmm. And Jill, you can maybe address that. But they do video analysis of gait for people who are athletes who are having difficulty with gait or running.
Right. So it's a 6 video motion capture system, and it's on 2 treadmill belts that can actually see how much load you're putting through each leg. So it can see how quickly you're loading your joints, if you're loading them evenly, things like that. It sounds to me like that might be too much for Kathleen right now. Depending on how things go, though, that might be some place that down the road she goes to. So I agree with you, Laura. I think probably starting with the outpatient neurologic rehabilitation with the UW Health System that's located in Middleton on University Avenue is probably a good place to start.
Yeah, that's probably where I would go.
Me too.
Kathy in Dodgeville will give you a chance now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello to your guests. I'm 71 years old, and I have a BMI of 45 and a half. I need a right reverse shoulder replacement. Mm. I'm bone on bone in my knees. I have Sjogren's syndrome, lots of arthritis, diabetes. I've tried Synvisc in my knees, steroids shots in my shoulder. I had a nerve ablation for the sensory suprascapular and auxiliary radio frequency ablation in January, which, you know, helped the nerves on the outside edge of my right shoulder. But, you know, I have a bone hook that cuts into my bicep tendon.
Big lanioacromian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have pain down my right arm. And I'm right-handed, so I really can't use my right arm. I can't lift or carry anything. My Medicare Advantage plan tells me my BMI is too high. I need to be either a 40 or a 42, depending on who I talk to, and they won't approve surgery. So I'm not sure where to go with this.
Right. You have a very extensive medical history. Have you tried exercising in a pool?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I do pool therapy.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
So are you achieving a sufficient dosage of activity to impact your BMI is part of the question. So, you need to be exercising probably 5 days a week in the pool at a sufficient intensity to start to impact your BMI. Is that accessible to you?
No.
Okay. So that's where I would focus my energy, is being able to do that. Otherwise, from my experience, it's really difficult to achieve a sufficient dosage of exercise to impact BMI. And obviously, that has to be paired with good nutrition.
Right.
If you haven't seen a registered dietitian to help with that piece of it, those two, the exercise and the nutrition, go hand in hand.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to John in Sun Prairie next. Hi, John. Hi, John. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, about 8 months ago, I had an incident where a garage door spring broke and the door fell down on the top part of my foot.
Oh,
ouch.
Caused me a little bit of stress.
I bet.
It all got different colors and blistered up and all of that sort of thing and swelled up, and it took a few months to really get back to walking, but I walk fine now. But I still have, it's hard, you know, that the whole top of that foot, I say it's not really swollen like because of water. I think it's because of the bone. Would there still be a bone bruise in there? I can walk on it pretty much without, I don't have any pain when I walk, but sometimes it tingles on top. It like it's pins and needles on top of my foot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of soft tissue, as you know firsthand now, from on the top aspect of your foot. So we know that a bone bruise, where you kind of irritate the periosteum of the bone, and it feels somewhat like a dull, boring toothache is how a lot of people describe it. You can actually get a little thicker along there. And so the symptoms that you're describing, or the thickness that you're experiencing, I would say is could definitely be due to a bone bruise, especially if a garage door, something that magnitude, landed on your foot.
Right, right. And all those soft tissues and connective tissues, there's a lot of ligaments in that area. And when they receive that kind of an impact, they're going to respond by, we call it proliferating. So you may get thickening in some of those ligaments. You may get a little bit more bone that gets laid down in that area because your body's responding to a stress that it has encountered there. And so there are natural mechanisms that your body goes into to protect that area. And it often involves laying down either scar tissue or additional bone or so on. So you probably have a number of those things going on. Just the things to look out for: make sure that you're not changing your gait, you're not changing how you walk or move, so that you are loading your foot differently, because that'll cause some issues down the road. But for having a garage door fall on your foot and you're back to walking normally, congratulations.
Yeah, for sure. John, good luck. Thank you very much. Let's go to Bill from Barneveld, Wisconsin. Hey, Bill.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a traditional archer and bow hunter, and a year ago in January, in late fall, I overshot my bow. I think I shot too much when I pounded. I was too heavy, and I developed, I think, what's tennis elbow or archer's elbow, and I immediately put the bow down. Well, not quite immediately. And I did some research online, and I saw exercises to do for tennis elbow, but it said do not start these until you're pain-free. Well, it took me a year and a half to get pain-free. I only got pain-free about a month ago, so this is a year and a half. I'll just tell you some things I was doing. I don't know. They seem to help, but I'm not sure. I did see a body worker in Madison, not a professional physical therapist per se, but somebody is recommended. And he did a few sessions of really like deep massage mm-hmm. of that area, which it felt much better afterwards. And I've been using one of these 10, you know, mm-hmm. electrical stimulators on it to try to stimulate blood flow. And one thing that seemed to help, but, you know, correlation isn't always causation. I started wrapping it in hand warmers just to get some blood flow to those tendons. So now I'm pain-free, and I haven't picked up the bow yet. I'm a little bit concerned to do that, and I wonder what advice you have from this point onward. Thank you very much.
Right. So it sounds like you do have lateral epicondylia. If you're tender over kind of the lateral side and gripping things, which you'd have to do with bow hunting, and then kind of going into a little bit of wrist extension or using those muscles, those tendons to stabilize is typically what we see with people with lateral epicondylia. It does take a while to get it calmed down. Unfortunately, I personally disagree with the wait until you're pain-free to start exercising. If people waited until they were pain-free to start exercising, I don't think any of us would get any exercise in. But it's got to be a manageable pain, and it's got to be a controlled pain. So I'm guessing, have you done any strengthening exercises for this, Bill?
No, I'm okay. going to start that. And just as an endorsement, two weeks ago while trout fishing, I ran into a doctor of, he's a muscle skeletal specialist, an MD. We spent a few days together, and he said the same thing. He said, no, you should have been working on this while you're in pain. You shouldn't
right.
have left it this long.
Right, so, exactly.
Just to clarify, it's the left arm, I'm right-handed, it's the left arm where I have to hold the bow straight out. It's not yeah. the drawing arm, it's the
okay.
arm where I hold the bow, and there's just like a lot of backward pressure on my forearm and elbow, you know, holding the bow at full extension.
Got it. That makes sense. You need to see a physical therapist. It would be great to have some very specific strengthening exercises performed, not only for your left arm, which is the arm that holds, but actually for your right arm is the arm that pulls back. So you can imagine in a year and a half's time without any specific exercises, strengthening exercises, there's probably some atrophy and muscle weakness to this. I would definitely not jump right back into bow hunting. A physical therapist could give you some very sport specific, if you will, strengthening exercises or strategies to do prior to bow hunting.
Right, because those muscles and tendons are not going to be ready to hold the load of that bow. So some fairly basic wrist strengthening, and then part of me says, wouldn't it be great to use holding or pulling the bow as part of the functional progression?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you could decrease the tension
right.
in the bow so you could practice just standing and holding and pulling the bow at a lower intensity or a lesser volume of activity, you could use holding the bow and pulling it back as part of your training and rehab.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to jump in to the same level you were at before, if that makes sense.
Good luck, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Linda in Sheboygan next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a question. I had knee replacement surgery this past October and have had physical therapy, and it's progressed well, except I have now a Baker's cyst behind that knee, and I'm wondering if they have a suggestion to help me with that.
And that developed after the knee replacement surgery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the Baker's cyst, and we see lots of people with Baker's cyst, is like it's a weak spot in your capsule, your joint capsule. And it's like a bubble on a tire. So when your joint gets swollen, that cyst sort of puckers out. And then for some people, when the knee is less swollen, it recedes some and it's not as evident. So does that happen to you, Linda, or is it always there?
It seems to come and go.
Okay. So then part of it is titrating your activities and being aware of when you're on your knee a lot and causing some of that swelling. and then think about icing afterwards, or if you know that you're going to be up and doing a lot of walking, you might want to pull on knee sleeve to control some of the swelling and prevent that Baker's cyst in the first place. So it really comes down to controlling the swelling within your knee joint. Other than that, there's no treatment or intervention for the Baker cyst. They don't go in and take out a cyst or anything in that part of your knee. So it's not worth the risk. It's more of an annoyance for people than anything.
Right.
Linda, good luck. Thank you. Terry emailed her question. Terry's question is related to flexibility. She says, I feel that my joints are maybe getting too loose. My shoulders especially seem to move around in the socket more than they used to. Is that normal part of aging? Is it something that can be looked at by a physical therapist?
So interestingly, typically with the aging process, and I don't know how old Terry is, but as we age, our joints actually get a little stiffer. So I'm not really sure why Terry is seeing an increase in the joints unless they are feeling looser in their joints because they're losing some neuromuscular control or muscle control. But either way, seeing a physical therapist would be a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jill's absolutely right. Typically what we see as people get older is they get a little stiffer and they have less flexibility in their joints. So I'm wondering if weakness is the underlying issue. So that's importantly, you would want to have that looked at so that it doesn't result in some kind of an injury or additional problem. So.
And Sarah emailed, and she injured her knee back in the beginning of May. Her visit to orthopedic doctor resulted in the doctor telling her she should thought it was a bad strain and gave it 4 to 6 weeks to recover. It's improved, but there's pain, especially with pivoting to the point I have to work through excruciating pain until it passes. She's wondering if she might have re-injured it.
Well, a strain is typically what we see with a muscle. And early May, that we were already 6 weeks out, if it was a muscle strain, she should be feeling better. The pivoting is very concerning to me. If she has where she feels episodes of instability or feels like her knee is going to give way when she pivots, I'd be concerned about an intra-articular injury such as an ACL tear. We don't know her mechanism of injury here or what first brought it on, but this isn't making sense to me.
No, not at all. Not at all. So if it was just a strain, she should be better by now. And Jill's absolutely right. The pivoting is an issue. Mm-hmm. So she needs to get in and see somebody and have this looked at.
Yeah. Potentially yeah. imaged. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah. yeah.
And on that happy note, we are out of time again. So good to see you guys in the studio. I hope we can do this again next month when you're on again. Thanks to Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, and Lori Tyne-Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Just a reminder, our next book club show is coming up on Thursday. We'll talk with the author of South of Luck, Jim Gould of Hudson, Wisconsin. Book's a coming-of-age story, a lot of fun read, actually. It takes place on a farm in rural northwest Wisconsin in the mid-40s. So hope you can join us with your thoughts and questions about the book. That's Thursday, June 23rd from 11 to noon. Tomorrow we'll talk about training yourself to be mentally fit to take anything that life throws at you. Another author with us. And then at 11:45 we look at what you can see in the night sky this summer. That's Tuesday right here on the Ideas Network. And in the meantime, I hope you will stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.